This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Blueprint for Wealth, a program dedicated to securing your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. Now, here's your host, Wayne Zell.
Good morning and welcome to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, your host of this very fast-paced half hour of special topics and special guests designed to help you realize your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by Odin Feldman and Pittleman, a full-service law firm located in Fairfax, Virginia, serving the entire Washington, D.C. metro area with clients all across the country. If you'd like to know more about OF&P, visit us on the web at www.ofplaw.com. Also, if you'd like to make an appointment with one of our attorneys, call us at 703-218-2100. I also invite you to subscribe to my blog, blueprintforwealth.org, where you can find audio, video, and written articles on topics of interest in tax, estate planning, and business planning. Today, we're going to talk about where you live, or at least where the state governments think you live, and we're going to talk about the concept of domicile or residency. State governments are more than ever struggling to meet their budget deficits, but the legislators often find that raising taxes and cutting programs just aren't the best ways to get reelected. Instead, many states have found new ways to plug holes in the budget, increasing revenue through heightened audit enforcement, for example. And what better way to get revenue than to go after the high net worth individuals who are the corporate jet owners or others who may be construed as being high net worth, and they claim they don't even live in the state. Indeed, those folks don't even vote in the state elections. But increasingly, state governments are turning to their own state tax departments and empowering them to mine their database of high net worth individuals and look for residency targets. Now, there are two basic ways, at least in the local states of Virginia, Maryland, D.C., and even Delaware, that an individual is determined to be a resident of that state. Different jurisdictions have different rules, but like I said, in the local states, residency is the most important concept. The taxing structure for residents is really simple. Residents are taxed on one thing, everything. If you qualify as a resident of the state of Virginia, for example, Virginia has the authority to impose taxes on all of your income, regardless of its source. Non-residents are only taxed on income with a source in the state. As we're going to talk about today, states have some sort of mechanism to ensure that taxpayers get credit in their home state for taxes paid to other states on certain types of income. But often these credits may not be sufficient to relieve the individual from double taxation. Now, like I said, there are two basic ways in which residency is established. The first test is if you're quote-unquote domiciled in the state. If so, then you're taxable as a state resident. Many states use this same definition, so it's really important to understand what domicile means. It really refers to one's principal, primary, and permanent home, really where you intend to be. And the test of intent with respect to a domicile depends on where your place of habitation is, where your permanent home is, with the range of sentiment, feeling, and permanent association with it. In other words, where are your things? Where are your valuables located? If they're in your residence and that residence is in the state, then you're deemed to have a permanent place of residence in the state. Over the years, to help auditors figure out where somebody's permanent home is located, there are factors that have been developed for determining residency. These factors are the focus of residency audits in almost every state tax audit. They include your home, where you're actively involved in your business, the time you spend in that location, near and dear items where you keep them, and where your family is located. When you're planning a move outside of your state of residence, taxpayers need to be sure that most or all of these factors weigh in favor of their new home state. All of these factors, we often find the time factor is the most important and instructive in domicile cases. If a taxpayer doesn't spend more time in their claimed home than in any other location, the auditor is going to have questions. In audits, they're looking to demonstrate that the taxpayer spends more time outside of the home or in the home than anywhere else. So it isn't always determinative how much time you spend, but it is an important factor. Taxpayers who steer clear of the domicile test aren't out of the woods because Virginia, Maryland, D.C., like many other states, has an alternative test for residency, the statutory residency test. If you maintain a permanent home in the state and you spend more than 183 full or partial days in that state during the year, you're going to be deemed a statutory resident. Over the past year, there have been many cases in and outside of our local jurisdictions highlighting problems and difficulties that can arise in these statutory residency cases. On the number of days issue, there was a recent case in New York involving the noted hedge fund manager Julian Robertson. And it's high-stakes poker. In the matter of Robertson, the issue concerned the taxpayer's location in or out of New York City over the course of 2 days during a particular tax year. Why was that important? Why were those 2 days important? Because if he was deemed to be a New York City resident during those 2 days, then he would have had an additional $26 million tax bill. I've heard advisors referring to other factors that are important in determining residency or domicile, such as where you have your voter's registration card, or where your driver's license was issued, where you keep your bank accounts, where your safe deposit boxes are. These and many other factors are important, but may not be determinative in determining domicile. But a court will be influenced, for example, if you claim to have Virginia residency, but your driver's license is issued in Delaware and you haven't bothered to change your driver's license. The auditor and the courts will be interested in finding out why you haven't changed your driver's license. Now, if you're at an age where changing your driver's license may be difficult, then that's a good explanation supporting why you may not have changed it. But voters' registration cards, bank accounts, safe deposit boxes, all of those things and many other factors are important, if not critical, in helping bolster your case. But remember, the most important factor, as we indicated before, is where you maintain that permanent home and how much time you're spending in that jurisdiction, whichever one that you're trying to claim as your domicile. Be careful of potential contradictions that can arise where you're either very cheap or simply not paying attention to the details. For example, I've seen situations where somebody has claimed a change of residency outside of a state, but nonetheless applied for that state's fishing or hunting license to save a few bucks on a registration fee. I've also seen people claim tax relief under a specific program or property tax exemption that might be available in their former state of residence simply because they want to save a few hundred or thousand dollars. But when it comes down to it, where do they really reside? Try to identify any registrations or exemptions that you might have based on some sort of residency exclusion, and make sure that all of your exemptions and all of your registrations are consistent with the facts that you're trying to claim in your case. Make sure everything gets switched, in other words. Some taxpayers brush aside dual residency concerns because they're under the impression that double taxation is constitutionally prohibited, or that states have credit mechanisms in place to restrict double taxation. This is a mistake. In fact, double taxation in the residency area is all too common. How does it happen? The main problem is created by the state's tax credit mechanisms. Despite what many people believe, states won't provide a credit for any and all taxes imposed by other jurisdictions. First, the credit is generally limited to residents of that state. So if a taxpayer is a resident of the state, the taxpayer could qualify to receive a credit for taxes paid to another state. But here's where the issue gets trickier. Many states limit the extent of that credit. New York is a good example. In New York, residents are permitted to take a credit for any income tax imposed for the year by another state on income derived from and subject to tax under New York law. So New York provides a credit for taxes paid to other states only to the extent the income is sourced to that state under New York's sourcing rules. So if a New York resident pays tax to Wisconsin because the taxpayer worked half of the year in Wisconsin, then New York will provide a credit for the Wisconsin tax because under New York's rules, the tax was properly payable to Wisconsin because the taxpayer was working there. But if the taxpayer ended up qualifying as a Wisconsin resident and was taxed on all of his income, including income from interest and dividends and capital gains, then New York wouldn't give a credit for the Wisconsin tax paid on those items of income. So residency for income tax, estate tax purposes, is an important consideration, but you just can't make generalizations or assumptions regarding whether or not you're a resident of one state or another. If you need help in determining your residency status, give us a call at OF&P at 703-218-2100. I'm Wayne Zell, and you're listening to Blueprint for Wealth.
You're listening to Blueprint for Wealth with Wayne Zell. Learn how to better prepare for your future when Blueprint for Wealth returns in just a few moments.
A Legal Minute with Wayne Zell.
Trusts are essential in creating various strategies for accomplishing asset protection, estate planning, and privacy benefits. They've been around for several hundred years, and they have certain essential characteristics. They have one or more trustees who are responsible for administering and carrying out the trust, and beneficiaries who are entitled to trust income or principal, currently or in the future. A trust is typically in the form of a written agreement between a settlor, the creator of the trust, and a trustee. The written agreement provides the settlor will transfer certain assets to a trustee, and the trustee will hold those assets for the benefit of named beneficiaries. Until recently, trusts were only for the wealthy, but that's no longer the case. Now, those with equity in a family home or savings put away for retirement or college are using trusts as an essential ingredient in their estate plans. If you'd like to know more about trusts, give us a call at 703-218-2100.
Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth, a program dedicated to securing your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. If you have questions for Wayne, you can email him at radio@ofplaw.com or call him 703-218-2100. Now back to your host, Wayne Zell.
Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, and with me today is my partner and special guest, Dave Zangrilli. Welcome back, Dave.
Good morning, Wayne. Thanks for having me.
He's going to talk about the wonderful topic of divorce. Which is what he does all day long. Like, I deal with death all day long, and Dave deals with divorce all day long. So we're a real exciting couple of guys here. And we're going to talk about what happens to the house, the homestead, the family home, which is not, I don't think, an easy topic to talk about, but there are a lot of nuances that come up in this, aren't there?
There's a lot of nuances. It's always a hot-button issue for a variety of reasons. Some people want the house because it's a valuable asset. Some people don't want to have to go out and move, buy a new house. Some
right.
people feel that it gives them a leg up in a custody battle to stay in the house where the kids have lived.
Interesting.
Some spouses want it just because he wants it or she wants it, so therefore I want the house.
I want it even more.
Exactly.
Right?
That's exactly
so
right.
I guess the first step is, you know, the couple gets separated. What happens with the house then?
you know, over the last probably 2 years or so, we've seen a trend with the economy that more and more divorcing spouses are staying living in the same house during the separation.
No way.
Which is, you know, it's kind of like the War of the Roses, the old movie with Michael Douglas. It's not a fun situation, especially if there's children involved.
Kathleen Turner.
Exactly.
I remember that.
I haven't had the case yet where the people have drawn the line down the middle of the house, but I'm sure I will eventually. You know, it's just too expensive for folks to have to move out, maintain two separate households.
Right.
So one of the first questions I'm always asked at the initial meeting is, well, how do I kick him out or how do I kick her out?
Is it possible to do that?
It is possible, but it's very difficult.
Okay.
So often I have to be the bearer of bad news.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most of the judges in Virginia, at least in Northern Virginia, will not kick a spouse out unless there's been some domestic violence.
Okay.
Even in a situation where you have one spouse who makes a tremendous amount of money and can clearly afford to move out.
Okay.
Judges are just very leery about doing that, which puts people in the situation of having to remain living in the same house during the separation.
So it is possible to live in the same house during the separation period. One person takes a – you can't stay in the same bed, though, can you?
That's right. If you want to get divorced based upon the grounds of being separated for 1 year,
right,
you kind of have to almost be like two ghosts in the night. One person's in one bedroom, one person's in another bedroom. And you're not doing stuff for the spouse. You're not cleaning up after him or her. You're not cooking dinner for him or her. You're not sitting down and eating meals together, watching TV together. You can't go places together with the kids. So you really have to be two ghosts.
Two distinct entities.
Exactly.
So who pays the mortgage and the utilities and the taxes during this whole time period?
There's really no rule, which can create a lot of difficult situations where you get into a situation where the husband says, well, I'm not paying. And wife says, well, I'm not paying either.
So then you go to foreclosure.
Right.
Have you seen that happen?
Oh, yeah. Not really? Very often. Usually the court will step in before it gets to that point. See, going back a step, there's no rules. So usually the parties just have to try to work it out amongst themselves.
Okay.
The judges do not want to order one person or the other to pay for certain things while they're still living in the same house. The judges don't like to micromanage the situation.
Okay.
But if a spouse stops paying the mortgage, or I've had cases where the spouse stopped paying the utilities and the power gets cut off.
Oh, my.
Then the court will usually step in and say, okay, this is absurd. You know, husband, you're going to pay the mortgage, or the parties, you're going to pay 50-50 or whatever.
Especially if husband is the sole breadwinner in the family or wife is the sole breadwinner in the family, I guess a judge is going to be a little bit empathetic to the other person who may be taking care of the kids or something
right.
like that.
That's right? Exactly right.
Now, can one person force a sale of the house?
Not during the separation.
Okay.
Usually that's something that sometimes the parties will agree, obviously. But if the parties don't agree, then you have to wait until the final trial day for the court to make a ruling as to who's going to keep the house or if the house is going to get sold. Even in a situation where the house is solely titled in one person's name, whereas technically they really can sell the house because they don't need the other spouse to, you know, sign off on the sales contract or any of that stuff.
Huh.
If they tried to sell the house, the court would step in and say, hold on, you're not doing that.
Does the rule vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction? So outside of Virginia, you might see a different rule. I mean, in Maryland, for example, or DC, or, you know, different rules all across the country. Who knows? I mean, you really have to go to a divorce lawyer in your jurisdiction. So we have a lot
That's
of
right.
listeners in Maryland and DC. We deal primarily with Virginia divorce.
Correct.
And if that ever came up, we'd be happy to refer you to somebody in that instance.
No question about it, because each state, each jurisdiction is different.
And there is no rule of thumb.
No.
So how does a Virginia court decide at trial who gets to keep the house or whether the house has to be sold? I mean, what are some of the factors that they look at when this arises?
Sure. There's a few different options. Let's say the husband wants it and the wife does not want it.
Mm-hmm.
Then the court will give the house to the husband, assuming, of course, that if they have a jointly titled mortgage, that the husband can, within some reasonable period of time, 60 days or 90 days, something like that, can qualify to refinance and have the other spouse removed. If they can, then great. The husband would keep the house and, you know, the court would presumably order the husband to pay the wife 50% of whatever equity there may be in the house.
But that may not be easy today, particularly in today's environment where banks are not so willing to refinance properties, particularly with only one name on that mortgage.
That's right. Times have changed. And even with the change in the jumbo rates now in the Northern Virginia area, it's become harder for people who have $700,000, $800,000 homes to be able to refinance. Unfortunately, you know, when you represent the stay-at-home mom and they say, I want to keep the house, oftentimes, unfortunately, I have to tell them, you know, you're not going to be able to qualify. There's no way you're going to be able to qualify, even if the husband is paying you alimony and child support. If you're not working, unless you have a family member who will co-sign with you, there's just no way you're going to be able to qualify for a mortgage.
Which is really, really sad in today's environment. And it's probably the hardest on the kids.
That's right.
As opposed to the the spouses.
So if you have a situation where both parties want the house, then oftentimes the court would just say, sell it. And then sometimes you have a situation where neither party wants the house. And of course, the court will also order that it be sold.
Well, if you're in trial and you haven't been able to negotiate some kind of settlement in a separation property settlement agreement, then you're right. I mean, the court has no other choice.
Right.
It's not going to side with one side or the other, is it?
They often won't unless there's a really good reason to. If you have a situation where, for example, husband had moved out of the house a year ago.
Okay.
And for whatever reason now says, yeah, I want the house. But wife's been living there with the kids.
Right.
Well, then it's more likely the judge would give her the house as opposed to the husband.
Okay. Okay. Now, what are some of the considerations that come into play when they're making a decision as to who gets the house or whether it should be sold? I guess appraisals have to be obtained, don't they?
Yeah, that's always kind of the first step to figure out if there's any equity in the property.
Okay.
And the easiest way to do that is to just hire a licensed real estate appraiser. Usually it's most cost efficient to just agree with the other lawyer and say, hey, you know, we know the three or four appraisers that everybody uses. Let's use one of these folks, have them do the appraisal. It'll cost you about $500, and that will establish the fair market value.
And you'll agree that the appraisal will establish the fair market value of the
house? Yes. Because sometimes parties don't, you know, invariably the husband or wife won't trust the other spouse's appraiser.
Right.
They think they're for hire.
So get your own.
Exactly. But 99 out of 100 times, the two appraisers' appraisals are within $10,000, $15,000.
Really?
So it's just not worth fighting over, quite honestly.
I mean, we've had situations, not in real estate, but in business valuations where we'll get... Each party will get their own appraiser, and then they'll have to pick a third appraiser, and the two closest, the average of the two closest, ends up being the binding appraisal. But that's an expensive proposition when
especially
you're doing businesses.
I do a ton of business appraisals, and you're right, the range of potential
fees.
Opinions is huge.
And the fees are enormous
exactly.
for valuing a business. Now, what happens if one of the parties, you know, let's say the husband is the primary breadwinner, allows the wife to stay in the house, and pays the mortgage and the utilities during the period that the wife is in the house, but before the trial or before the separation agreement has been achieved. Do they get credit for these mortgage payments?
They can. They always ask, and of course that makes sense to ask for it. Usually what the judge will do is not give the party who paid the mortgage credit for the entire payment, but just give them credit for the amount of actual principal reduction.
Okay.
So, you know, oftentimes your mortgage is $2,000 a month, but in reality, only about $500-ish goes towards the
principal. I wish my mortgage was $2,000 a month.
Yeah, that makes two of us.
Yeah.
So usually the court will give them credit for the actual principal that they have reduced.
Okay. And let's say somebody keeps the house and then the house ultimately gets sold. How do you factor in closing costs? I mean, there are obviously some closing costs you really can't anticipate at the time of the property settlement, and the property may not be sold for 6 months or a year or 2 years later.
Right. Good question. There's actually two issues with closing costs. The first one is the more difficult issue, and that's when, you know, in a negotiation, for example, the wife keeps the house and she says, okay, we've done the appraisal. The house is worth $500,000.
Okay.
We know the mortgage is worth $300,000.
Okay.
Or you owe $300,000. So there's $200,000 of equity in it. And the wife says, well, I may sell the house someday, and it's going to cost me 6 or 7%. So we need to knock that off.
Okay.
And then, husband, I'll give you 50% of whatever's left.
Okay.
And the husband says, well, wait a minute. How do I know that you're ever going to sell this house? Why am I going to give you credit for what I call phantom closing costs? And that's the age-old argument. In every case, the lawyers argue back and forth on that issue. And I can tell you that the judge will not count that. So if you walk into court and say, hey, judge, I want the house— but when we determine the equity, I want you to knock off 6% off the top.
No way.
The court's not going to do that.
That makes sense because you don't know what the ultimate closing costs are going to be at this time.
And you don't know if the person's ever going to sell the house.
Exactly.
They may keep
That's
it for 30 years.
Thing. That's the most important thing. I think you said that very, very, very well. What happens if I took assets, not me because I'm not getting divorced, but what happens if somebody took assets that they acquired before getting married or that they inherited from, you know, their family? And they invested it into the house, and the house was titled in joint name, tenants by the entireties or joint name.
Mm-hmm.
Do I get credit for that?
It's a very common situation and one that's heavily litigated. Essentially, the court has discretion. We have a rule that comes out of a famous case, I think it was in Kentucky, called Brandenburg versus Brandenburg, and everybody knows it. It's called the Brandenburg Rule.
Okay.
And not to bore you with all the details, but essentially, if you put in $20,000 of premarital money towards a down payment on a house.
Okay.
and the house appreciates. Well, the argument goes, I could either get $20,000 back or I can get some appreciation on top of that $20,000.
Based on the percentage of the equity that I or whatever I contributed towards the purchase price, right?
That's right. The court uses a formula where, let's say, you own the house 20 years, and during that 20 years, you paid the mortgage down by $80,000.
Okay.
So now there's been a total of $100,000 applied towards the principal.
All right.
20% of that is a separate property.
Okay.
80% of that is marital money.
I got it.
So then the house sells, and there's X number of dollars in proceeds. Under the argument, the husband would get 20% as his own separate property.
Mm-hmm.
Then the remaining 80% of net sales proceeds is 50-50 because that was marital.
Right.
But that's just a rule of thumb. The judges don't have to abide by that. They can do more than that. They can do less than that.
It's interesting because shouldn't you have just kept the marital the non-marital property separate and not invested it into a joint asset? And wouldn't the counter argument be that, hey, look, you commingled these assets with your spouse, and so therefore they should partake of that?
Those are the two arguments. The bigger argument is usually that the person can't trace the money. You know, 10 or 15 years go by and people forget how much they actually contributed. People don't have the documents to prove it. And it's a very forensic tracing exercise to try to prove to the court, look, Judge, here's all my documentation showing this was my money originally. This is where I deposited this money into.
Yeah, cut a check out of this account that I had in my own name.
That's right.
That's the easiest proof.
Right.
Now here's a tough question. We're closing in on on the end of our program, but what happens if we've got negative equity? Because negative equity is probably more commonplace today than positive equity.
That's right.
In a lot of these, the house is upside down.
Right. It's become a huge problem.
Yeah.
It's something we didn't see 5, 6, 7 years ago. And judges are doing different things depending on the judge. Some judges will do nothing.
Okay.
Meaning if you walk into court with a house that has negative equity, the judge will make rulings on all the other issues, custody, visitation, alimony, what have you, but just keep the party as owners of the house and send them on their way and say, you know what? You guys deal with the house as you see fit. Then that creates a bunch of issues. The parties are divorced.
Right.
They still own this house together. They have to figure out what the heck they're going to do with it.
Yeah. I mean, what happens if one of the parties makes it difficult to let the other party sell the house? The other party wants to sell the house. And then just out of spite, the party who's in the house makes it difficult. What do you do?
In a situation like that where the judge refuses to do anything, they actually have to file a partition lawsuit, which is extremely expensive.
After divorce, they become what's called tenants in common. Isn't that right?
That's absolutely right.
And so then you have the right to engage in this partition action.
Right.
Which can be expensive.
Very expensive, very time consuming.
So what's the lesson? Draft the property settlement agreement.
Draft a property settlement agreement with extremely tight provisions. You have to micromanage the situation and think about every issue that can arise in the sales process. Who's the realtor going to be? How often is the price going to be reduced? How much is the reduction going to be? Mm. Who's going to pay for repairs? Who's going to pay for HOA fees?
Wow.
All of that stuff. Because if you don't micromanage the situation in the property settlement agreement and you have a spouse living in the house who really does not want to leave, who does not want to sell, that spouse can make it very, very difficult and delay the sale.
We're talking to Dave Zangrilli, my partner and an expert in family law. Dave, if people want to get in touch with you, how do they get in touch with you?
Direct dial 703-218-2152, or they can shoot me an email at david.zangrilli@ofplaw.com.
And once again, a lot of information and a lot of expertise at our firm, Odin, Feldman & Pittleman. Call us if you need any help. I'm Wayne Zell. You've been listening to Blueprint for Wealth. And thanks for listening, and Happy New Year, a great topic to talk about on New Year's Eve. Have a great week.
You've been listening to Wayne Zell and Blueprint for Wealth. Wayne will be back next Saturday morning at 10 with your Blueprint for Wealth, right here on 1500 AM Federal News Radio.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now.